I'm Matt Downing, and welcome to Diving Deep EDU.
Curious conversations with all types of peeps, encouraging innovation, we are diving deep. Certainly education is what we like to speak, fervent with dedication, now it is time to teach. Yeah.
The Diving Deep EDU podcast aims to have thought-provoking conversations that help listeners dive deeper into educational practices with a focus on teacher retention, recruitment, and burnout. Subscribe to the Diving Deep EDU podcast newsletter to get more information about this podcast and these topics. A link is in the show notes. Our guest today is Stephen Guerrero. Stephen was a middle school social studies teacher for 20 years before moving into his current position as chief learning officer of a blended learning platform startup. His interests are ancient history, archaeology, and travel. He is an outspoken advocate for teachers, mental health, and the LGBTQ equity in the classroom and beyond. Stephen, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. I want to start the conversation off by you telling us a little bit more about the work you're currently doing.
Yeah, thanks so much. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be chatting with you. So right now, I'm working at a tech startup, which is a world away from middle school social studies teaching. it's a lot more kind of nimble and dynamic, but it's also a lot more without boundaries in a way that, you know, the very rigorous classroom schedule puts around you. So right now we're building an AI-informed platform to bring blended learning in a, you know, all out-of-the-box package. We work both in the US and in India. And we are, yes, small now, but we are looking for our pre-seed funding to explode out of the gate. And we think we have some really great features that teachers will love. And aside from that, just I'm also still working with a professional development group that provides classes and a study tour of Greece to teachers who teach about ancient Greek legacy, history, culture, all that. So I keep one leg in the archaeology, ancient history world and one in the education technology world.
Now, you just got back from a trip.
I did.
You know, what were some of the things that you saw while you were there?
So we try to give the teachers who come with us a glimpse of kind of as much as we can in the time that we have. So we started in Athens. We were there during Easter, which is a really special time. It was the Orthodox Easter. And it was, you know, a really great glimpse into some of the, you know, new world and old world rituals coming together. So, you know, at midnight on Saturday into Sunday, the whole village will gather at the church. They bring a candle out that they say comes from the eternal flame in Jerusalem. The priest will come out, light it to the people near him. Those people will light it to the next people until the whole town square kind of has a candle in hand and fireworks overhead and the bells tolling. So it's a really special moment. And we bring the teachers to places like Delphi, where the oracle was, Olympia, where the Olympics started. And yeah, just show them kind of where ancient and modern Greece meet.
Yeah. What's a moment where teachers are there and they have that aha, wow, this is amazing what I'm seeing that they didn't necessarily expect prior to the trip?
You know, I think one of the most powerful kind of places and moments is when we bring them up on top of the Acropolis. And I know a lot of people like visualize the Acropolis. You have the Parthenon on top and, you know, it's kind of sticking up over Athens. But it's one of those places where you go there and it actually either lives up to or kind of goes beyond the hype that you kind of think in your mind. It's amazing. I mean, it's monumental. You go up there, it's purposefully built by the ancient Greeks to be impressive as you move up and kind of crescendo by getting to the top, seeing this amazing architecture, and then looking out across the entire, you know, city of 4 million people down to the Bay of Piraeus. So I think a lot of people are kind of almost stunned by you know, they're caught off guard. They're expecting like a postcard and they get it in a way that I think strikes a lot of people, you know, just so much history in a single place that you can really feel like you touch the past when you go up there.
And you were a middle school teacher for about 20 years. What drew you to that profession of being a teacher? And I'm also curious, like, what drew you to the middle school years? Because a lot of people run from those years, but you were there for quite some time.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. So I'll answer the second one first, which is middle school is very special. And it's for, you know, a certain contingent of teachers. And it's absolutely not for everybody. But I always loved the humor of it. Yeah. I mean, when you're spending your whole day with 11 and 12 year olds, like you cannot take yourself or anything really too seriously. And so, yeah, it's a special time. And you're also opening kids' eyes in a way that they're just realizing how big the world is out there. You know, in elementary school, it's more like, you know, they're home, they're school. It's kind of more of a closed system. And, you know, I had the opportunity to bring the ancient past to the kids in a way that they hadn't had before. And it's really exciting to see that. I went to Boston Latin here in Boston, and I had a kind of an ancient history heavy curriculum, which I always loved, and went to Boston University after that, and graduated in 2001, and it was kind of a down job market. And so I had actually majored in international relations, and I took the Foreign Service exam, fully intending to be a diplomat for the Foreign Service. And that's a long process, and it took me all summer. And by the time September rolled around, I was looking for a job, and a friend of mine's mom was a special ed liaison in a local elementary school. And she said, why don't you come be, a TA, and, you know, you can do your Foreign Service kind of process while you do it. And then, you know, kind of if people could see me doing air quotes, like you get a real job, you know, once that happens. And I was a assistant teacher in grades 3 through 5, working with, you know, special education students and helping implement their IEPs. And I had never had any teaching experience before that, but I just loved it. It was awesome. Mm. The kids were great. Every day was like a different new challenge. It really was exciting to work closely with the kids. So I could go in different classrooms, see different teaching styles, and I just kept pushing it off and finished that year. And then a teacher went on maternity leave and the principal said, hey, would you like to go for this job? And it was a fourth grade teaching position. So that's how I started 20 years ago, 20 something years ago now.
And as you taught through the years, right, what were some things that energized you or kept you engaged in teaching, you know, middle school social studies? What were things that excited you about being a middle school social studies teacher?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's, what kept me in so long, which is, you know, I always, even from when I was little, like was obsessed with Indiana Jones and archaeology and that whole thing. And so I always had a passion for ancient history, specifically like Greek mythology, you know, Roman history. And so when I had the opportunity to move into teaching middle school, and instead of teaching all the subjects, I just could focus on ancient history. Yeah. It was so great because I could share my passion and nerd out in a way that I had a captive audience every day who couldn't wait to hear, you know, my next explanation of some amazing feature of the ancient past, of an ancient civilization. I taught about Mesopotamia and Egypt and Greece and Rome, and it was all the goodies. So it was fantastic. It was amazing. It was, one of my favorite things of the day.
So just to clarify for some of the listeners, they might be wondering, well, you went from this one degree at Boston College and you became a teacher. So before we go on any further into your teaching experience, can you clarify a little bit for me and the listeners, how did that take place from going from a TA and wanting to be a foreign diplomat, not having a teaching degree, to then becoming a teacher? Was it a private school? Did you end up getting your certification. Tell us a little bit about that process before I dig a little bit more into your middle school teaching experience.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Because it definitely was kind of a roundabout process. Mm-hmm. So I majored in international relations, and I, like I said, started the process of going into the Foreign Service. You take a written exam, and then there's a kind of a group activity. Like, I had to go to Washington, D.C. and participate in these, this like weekend of kind of events. And then there was also an interview, and all this is stretched over the time. And so once I got to be a TA, it was in a Title I school that really like needed personnel and needed help. And, you know, the principal, it was a very small school. Everybody knew.
But this is a Title I public school, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A local public school. Yeah. And in elementary school, it was 1 to 6. And it was, it just so happened that the end of the year when I was a TA, I really kind of thought about going for this job. And when this teacher went on maternity leave, because it wasn't a permanent position in that, like, she was planning to come back the following year, it was easier for me to get a temporary license sponsored by the principal.
So
I went through that, but also at the same time, so I went to Boston University undergrad, and then I went to Boston College for my master's in education.
Gotcha.
And I did that over a series of the school year and then the following summer, and kind of did it on an accelerated plan. But because of Massachusetts's ability to earn a preliminary license, mm-hmm. which is like good for 5 years, temporary, you're supposed to, you know, get a permanent license after that, I was able to teach for that time. And then once I got my master's degree and I decided this is really the job for me, I pursued like my, they call it initial and then my professional licensure.
Yeah, it's interesting. So one benefit from your experience, I bet, was you student taught, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you student taught while you were on payroll and getting paid from the district while you were getting your teaching certification. So right?
I actually didn't student teach. They wouldn't count it. So Massachusetts, the way the licensure is, it's so particular that this is actually kind of funny. 10 years into teaching, so around like 2011 or 2012, I went to go renew my license from initial to professional. And they told me that I would need to do student teaching. And I told like the state agency, like, I have been a classroom teacher for 10 years. Like, I have all my evaluations, I have a master's degree. I have the support of my principal and colleagues.
Bureaucracy,
and superintendent.
Yeah, that's tight.
Yeah, absolutely. And so they were like, okay, you can enroll in a student teaching program and be observed teaching in your own classroom while paying $12,000 in tuition.
Yeah.
Because it would count as a college credit.
So you had to do that?
No. Well, luckily, Massachusetts had this alternative plan called, it's an acronym. The acronym was called PURPLE, and it was like an alternative. But still, what it was, mm-hmm. the DESE, the Department of Education, sent somebody to also observe me in my classroom. I had to make a whole portfolio, and I only had to pay $2,500. Yep. And at the end of it, got my licensure,
hilarious.
Was so wild. Yeah, exactly. Because I hadn't intended to be a teacher and I hadn't done student teaching, that like came to bite me like 10 years later that I had to go through this ridiculous process.
So like that is ridiculous and that's bureaucratic. And even the fact that you had to pay $2,500 is out of control.
Yes.
But it still takes a barrier away from some people trying to get their teaching degree because mm-hmm. they're student teaching for free and some people aren't able to pay for their college degree, right? While they're teaching for free during the day, they had to quit their part-time job that they're mm-hmm. that they're doing while they're paying for college. A lot of people are advocating that student teaching becomes paid. Even if you're paying for it, you're still getting a paid stipend from the district where you're teaching, and it helps them pay, and we can build up the lifeline because it's, you know, such a barrier for access for so many people that are trying to pay for college, and they're like, man, I gotta do this for free, and it's you know, 15 weeks or whatever, and I have to pay for it. Like,
yeah, yeah. And it's crazy. I mean, by the terms of student teaching, like, you are taking over the responsibility.
Yes.
Like, you're grading, you're lesson yes. planning, you're doing the teaching, mm-hmm. like, you know, and that's a lot to do.
It's
a lot to ask. Yeah, absolutely. One of the better situations that I've seen is when, like, kind of in a situation like mine where somebody who is a teaching assistant wants mm-hmm. to get
yep.
their teaching degree, and maybe they have, like, an opportunity to kind of be a teaching assistant, but also, you mm-hmm. know, take over some classroom time, something like that. But yeah, it is wild to think about that we have students take over, you know, for 12 weeks or whatever, and do all the work and yep. get none of the, and do the paying,
and
you know, and to this college that has, like, you know, somebody check up on them, like,
yeah,
because even the responsibility of supervising is on the classroom teacher, not on the professor of the education program, which is
yeah.
even, you know, more kind of crazy mm-hmm. When you think about it.
Yeah, it's wild. I think there'll be a shift or whatever. I mean, everybody has these thoughts, but it seems like there's pressure at this point where there might become a shift to attract teachers to certain districts. So it might not be a statewide initiative, but a district might say, we want these student teachers and you'll mm-hmm. come here, you know, we'll pay you and then we'll offer you a job, you know, when it's done, because we need you and we want to recruit good people and have a pipeline mm-hmm. for access. But we'll see. I mean, there's a lot of talk, but
yeah. Yeah. And also, I mean, sometimes those initiatives are targeted to schools with the highest needs, understandably.
True.
But those are also schools, I mean, I'm Could thinking back to when I was, like, a first year teacher, like mm-hmm. those are the schools that are the hardest for first year teachers to really get their feet under them. I mean, mm-hmm. if you can do it, like, you learn a lot and you yeah. really get your sense of who you are as a teacher. But mm-hmm. You know, it's really a danger of kind of burning folks out even before they begin. I'm
yeah.
a big fan of, like, if we had more of an apprenticeship
yep.
kind of
yep.
model where
yep.
like you work and you're kind of like the teaching assistant
yep.
or, you know, there's a full year, because we all know as teachers, like, whatever you learn in the education prep program in the classroom, it's mm-hmm. interesting, but you can't actually learn to be a teacher unless
yeah.
you're doing the work of a teacher. And
yeah.
so that's why I think an apprenticeship model would make a lot more sense.
Yeah, without a doubt. It takes that, like, paid student teaching to the next level. It's not
yeah,
just
yeah.
for those 12 weeks, but for a longer period. Yeah, I really like that. And so you were a teacher and eventually you decided to shift out of the classroom. I'm sure there were many reasons behind that. You know, I'm and every person's situation is unique. But as we're talking here now and you're reflecting upon that, what are some major reasons behind that decision?
Yeah, I definitely have given it a lot of thought, because anyone who's either considering or who has, you know, left the classroom after some time knows that, like, it's not a snap judgment. Like,
yeah.
it's not something you just decide one day. It's something you stew on for, like, years in my case. And I think it's three main reasons. One
okay.
is that kind of the job of being a teacher changed. Number two, the kids at a macro level kind of changed. And number three, I changed. And I think, you know, in taking them, like, in order, the job of being a teacher, and I'm not the first one or won't be the last one to say, like, this kind of data-driven approach of making students into quantitative data generators kind of takes away a lot of the artistry of teaching. And so when you're so regimented in a way where, like, you know, every other social studies teacher has to be on the same, you know, lesson within the same week of each other, and we have, like, the same, you know, common assessments we have to give, and it just became so much more about data that mm-hmm. the lesson planning part of it and the kind of leeway that teachers, you know, old school teachers that I started working with had when they were interested in something or the kids were interested in something, they had a couple extra days to go into it. It just felt like, you know, the second week of school, you feel like you're already behind. And mm-hmm. like, how is that possible? But it always felt like that year after year. And then I'd say the kids have changed. And this is, like, where I'm in danger of, like, sounding old, but you know, I don't think we have fully come to grips with how technology and specifically, like, social media and
yeah.
also, you know, smartphones have changed the way kids interact with the world, including with their teachers. And so it felt like before kind of social media, there was much more of a chance to make an impact in kids' lives. Mm. And maybe it was a function of like the kind of, you know, town that I was teaching for, but you know, the kids were overscheduled. They had many more activities. It just felt like school was a smaller and smaller sliver of their time and attention. And that meant you had a smaller and smaller chance to really make a difference in their lives and in the way they thought about the world. And I think, you know, that part, and of course, like we're in a mental health crisis and, you know, there's this concept of emotional labor. And I think it originally came up as part of a study of actually flight attendants back in like the 80s. And they talked about how flight attendants had to manage their emotions even when people were at their worst and, you know, yelling at them or acting, you know, ridiculous on airplanes. And that kind of hypersensitivity and hypervigilance over your emotions, there's a part of that to teaching, right? Like it's a performative art. Like no matter how you're feeling, how your day is going, how your personal life is going, when, you know, a whole school fills up with kids, you have to turn on that energy to 60, no matter what time of the morning it is, no matter how you're feeling, you have to, you know, emote that energy and you have to absorb kind of the energy that the kids are giving you. Yeah. And so, you know, there's a limitation to how much that can handle, I mean, how much, you know, a teacher can absorb of that. And the last thing is I changed. Like when I started, I was like, you know, in my early 20s, I was single. I was easily devoting like all of my time and energy. Mm. You know, I was doing after school activities. I was even teaching like Saturday class, summer school. And, you know, now I'm married and my husband has a business and we have lives kind of more and more outside of each of our works. And I think, you know, your priorities kind of change as you get kind of more established and kind of prioritize things differently in life. And I think all of those things came together at the same time and really came to a head during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when we went out of school, it really blew up everything I thought I knew about my career trajectory and what my work day could look like.
Thanks for sharing that. Thanks for giving us a glimpse into the reasons behind that and being so specific as well. You talked about the sort of the first bucket at school changed and focusing so much on the data and not allowing, you know, creativity in the classroom and lesson planning and so forth. Can you explain a little bit more what you mean by that and how that like looked, how that change looked for you?
Yeah, definitely. And because I was a social studies teacher and we had a cluster model. So my cluster was, you know, the math teacher, the English teacher, and the science teacher and myself. And so I actually was in a privileged position because in Massachusetts, social studies is the only one of the four that don't have a state mandated test at the end of the year. And so I didn't have quite as rigorous kind of this standardization model that like the math teacher, for example, had. But yeah, there was just, you know, I also was a vice president of our teachers union. So I was involved in several of the contract negotiation cycles. And we would start the bargaining process by surveying all of our Unit A members. Oh. That's like teachers, counselors, nurses. You know, what are your priorities? What are you worried about? What, you know, what helps you do a good job and what gets in the way is the way we used to phrase it. Yeah. And, you know, more and more teachers would just be like, there's just so much. There's initiatives coming at us from the federal level, the state level, the local, my department, you know, right down to the principals in each school. And so, you know, all these initiatives were really well-intentioned, but, you know, we were asking teachers to do more and more and not giving them time to do it. And so, you know, that's just a recipe for frustration. And that's what came out. And I think, you know, this attitude of like, we need to make sure kids have a common experience, which is understandable, again, like reasonable. But to do so, we need to make sure all the teachers are doing all the same things, basically on the same days. And, you know, that is not, anyone who knows, like, has written a lesson plan and carried it out, you know, your lesson plan can look awesome on paper, but like, you know, 2 minutes into it, you're already making, you know, adjustments based on like what kids are asking and, you know, what they're responding to or what you have to review or something like that. So it just didn't allow for the art of teaching. Like, why do we ask teachers to have all this education, all this preparation, and then say to them, but what you're going to do is automate the lesson planning and carrying out that we tell you to. You know, that was hard to do. And again, I was in a privileged position because my subject actually had more leeway, whereas like my science and math colleagues, like they literally were day to day. Like the math teachers had to give like the same unit test on the same day to all the students in the school. And you know, that's a way to really take kind of some of the joy away from the actual job, because then you don't have as many opportunities for those unexpected happy moments to happen.
Thanks for explaining that. And thanks for giving that example to the art of teaching. So many district leaders or leaders in education that think they know everything and sort of want to point fingers at teachers just want more money. Teachers just aren't happy. Mm. If they could understand that many of the teachers that are unhappy just want the art of their craft to be elevated, and they want autonomy in the classroom and to be appreciated and supported, and so they can flourish and do more, I think that would go a long way. And as you interact with other teachers through your professional development, like you just went to Greece, you know, taking a bunch of teachers, and you still have a bunch of connections, and even, you know, the startup is connecting to education. What are some common stress points as you're talking to people? And again, I know everyone's situation is unique, but I just wanted to get a glimpse into what you're seeing. What are some common stress points that you see teachers are facing as you interact and talk to teachers?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, some of the things that I've kind of expressed, which is that teachers kind of losing some of the autonomy that they had in the classroom. I think it can't be ignored that we're coming out of, you know, a 2 to 3 year pandemic with substantial kind of remediation needed from the kids, which means even more for teachers to do on top of kind of the mental health crisis that we're facing that still we're not addressing in a systemic way. But I think one of the things that really kind of worries me is this move to kind of demonize teachers or hyper-politicize education in a way that I think has gone so overboard and is so informed by people's either misconceptions, misinformation, this idea that, you know, we have to remove books out of libraries, we have to police what teachers are saying, we have to, you know, shut down any sort of controversial topic in the curriculum. It's not as much, I mean, part of it is that like some of what they're eliminating is really, you know, detrimental to the students. I mean, as a formerly gay student and now gay adult, you know, it's really hard for me to see and think about what it would have been like when I was in school. This idea that, you know, people like you can't even exist in fiction books, so that we have to remove them, so, you know, no one is exposed to anyone who even has this attribute that you have. You know, what's the implicit message there? And then those are the specifics, but I think what's happening even more is this culture of fear that seems to be settling over kind of the teaching profession. This idea that if I say the wrong thing, if I mistakenly say something, or even if somebody just doesn't care for me, you know, a parent might come into the administration and make a big issue, or, you know, just, it's not even, it's not even a specific kind of problem more than just people are worried, people are nervous. And our profession is really struggling to recruit and retain, I think, because of that.
Yeah, that's really good insight. Thanks for sharing those stories and sharing the different stories that you've heard and bringing them together with those additional themes. I appreciate that. Stephen, it's time for the final word. What would you like to say to close out this podcast?
You know, this conversation really makes me think back to kind of my time in the classroom and where I am now. And I think, I know there are a lot of teachers who are in the classroom now who are thinking about moving out. And I would say, you know, every teacher has to do what's right for them. But I would also say, you know, it's incumbent upon districts, administrators, policymakers, that I hear a lot about recruitment but we really need to be focusing on retention because recruitment, bringing new people into the profession, is not a one-for-one swap for losing someone with tremendous institutional knowledge and experience. And I think, you know, recruitment is the promise and retention is kind of the carrying out of the promise. Yeah. And I think, you know, our teachers who are like 10, 15 years in, they are the ones most likely now to think about leaving in a way that, you know, teachers in years 1 through 3 were, you know, a while ago. And I think it's even more dangerous for the profession because you're losing those teachers who are training the new teachers, who are using their knowledge and experience to help teachers put things in perspective, to help parents put things into perspective. And I think we need to address it for the systemic crisis that it is. We can't just hope that we can bring new people in to replace the people who are leaving. We have to find out why people are leaving and address that.
Thanks for saying that. Before we end, who do you want to give a shout out to?
Ah, oh, that's a good question. I think I would love to give a shout out to two people, if that's allowed.
And, yeah, we'll let that slide.
So right now I'm the chief learning officer of Litmus Learn, which is an online blended platform ed tech. And the founder is Arvind and the CTO and co-founder is Guru. And those guys, you know, followed some of the stuff I was writing on LinkedIn. They thought I really had something, had some potential. And when I decided to leave the classroom, they were right there, like at the ready to ask me to come and join this dynamic, nimble startup. And so they took a chance on me and I do really appreciate that. And they have shown me kind of this world outside of education in the technology space that I never thought, you know, I would end up in.
Stephen, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast and all your insight. Listeners, thank you for joining us on the Diving Deep EDU podcast. If you liked this episode, subscribe, rate, review, and share it out. Until next time.
Wow, it's time to reflect. That's astounding. You've been checking out the podcast from Matthew Downing. Hope you like diving deep like a scuba diver. And the show provoked hope. That's our true desire.